Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hi, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Laura Rance. It used to be that the lowest price was the law when it came to food purchasing, but that's no longer always the case. Increasingly, the consumer looms like a large shadow over everyday decisions made on the farm and in food processing. Understanding the multitude of factors driving consumer preferences these days is a frustrating exercise for producers and companies alike. Is it price? Is it convenience? Is it nutrition, ethics, or taste? Sylvain Charlebois, also known as the food professor, is no stranger to these questions. He's been working with his colleagues at the universities of Dalhousie and Guelph to explore the science of food culture. He's joining me now. Welcome to Between the Rows.
Well, thank you, Laura.
First of all, what is the consumer in a Canadian context?
That's a really loaded question. Every day we see an example of how fragmented our marketplace is. More and more consumers are trying to find different things that are unique, different, and that is affecting the entire food supply chain from farm to fork, really. And more and more, I feel that farmers are really desperate to connect with consumers and try to understand them as much as possible, because it affects them. And what's different now than, say, 5-10 years ago is that it affects them much more rapidly. And so when we look at the whole issue of protein consumption,
right,
how more democratized it is now, it affects all farmers out there, and so that's why you kind of have to really keep your eyes out for any trends, and eventually you kind of have to adapt.
It seems, though, that we've actually moved beyond. I mean, it used to be that we talked about the consumer as though it was one entity, but what you're saying is that this is a very fragmented marketplace.
Oh, absolutely. And so you have, I think you're seeing the hyper-individualization of our food demand, and more people are looking for specific things. I'll just give you a couple of examples. So we now know that there are over 2.7 million Canadians that have either a food allergy or a food intolerance. That is way more than ever before. When it comes to proteins, everyone's got a different take on it. You have vegans. We estimate that there are almost 500,000 vegans in the country. Many vegetarians. You're looking at people who actually do lead a vegetarian lifestyle, but will eat some fish. And so you have about 72% to 73% of Canadians out there who don't really have any dietary preferences or restrictions. So, and that number is dropping every single year for one reason or another. And so that's why you really want to keep an open mind in terms of what people prefer. And of course, you have some consumers that really just can't eat certain products.
So, you know, there's a multitude of things driving these changes, but are there any clear winners emerging as far as the decision drivers? I mean, is price or convenience or the ethical equation, are those things that, are there any common trends that you're seeing in this?
I mean, overall, I think people are looking at values, at their own values. More and more, I think consumers are just allowing values and how they see the world affect their own food decisions more and more. I'll just give you a couple of examples. So animal welfare, climate change, and ethics. More and more consumers actually feel empowered to make a difference through their own food choices every single day. And the younger generation specifically, with the millennials and the Generation Z, they're actually the ones really affecting all of these changes. In fact, I mean, they outnumber now boomers, by far. And so obviously down the road, their economic influence will only increase.
Now, your most recent release centered around the new Canada Food Guide and where people turn to for their nutrition advice. And I think some would be very surprised to learn that most of us, particularly the younger generations, don't look to the food guide. So where are Canadians getting nutritional advice?
We were a bit shocked. Of course, it was a bit of a myth-busting sort of study that we actually conducted on the new food guide. A lot of people wondered whether or not consumers or Canadians care about the food guide, so we wanted to explore that dimension. The other one, of course, is the cost. We can get to that a little bit later, but essentially, when it comes to the food guide and how influential it is, we see no evidence that the food guide is very influential, and I think it has a lot to do with the fact that it has been largely forgotten by the adult population. You learn it in school. We have institutionalized the food guide, but you don't really pay attention to the food guide all that much once you leave school. The most influential people are family and friends. That's the number one choice. Secondly, you have general research with social media, of course, and then you have cookbooks. You also have TV documentaries, and a lot of them are really critical towards farming in general. We all know them, and the ones that are really usually very good and very sound don't get as much attention, unfortunately. And then you have the food guide in sixth place, and after that you have health professionals. And health Wow. professionals are dietitians, nutritionists, and doctors. So you can see that really across the supply chain in agriculture, you do see a lot of professions having a hard time connecting with consumers. And I would include farmers. Farmers have desperately tried to tell their stories through social media, to a right. certain extent, successfully or unsuccessfully, that's up for debate. But nutritionists and dietitians for years have been trying to convey to the public a very, very specific message around health, and nobody seems to want to listen to them.
It must be really difficult for your team when you sit down to do a survey to sort of figure out what questions to ask and how to frame them without driving the answers that you want.
Oh, absolutely. So so when we go out to field, we do pre-tests, of course, and we get about 50 people that we trust to go through the questionnaire with a fine-tuned comb. I mean, the most important thing as researchers is to do two things during the pretest. One, are you measuring what you want to measure? And secondly, you want to make sure that the instrument, the questionnaire, is not confusing. And so once we achieve both, then we go to field and collect the data, and that's really up to the data to come up with the stories. We just basically report the stories back to Canadians once we release the study. So it's really a matter of doing all the steps right at the beginning before we actually go to field.
So how can farmers use the data that you collect to make decisions about how they operate their businesses in this kind of environment?
I think it's really about positioning. I mean, you have to, as farmers, and frankly, I see it more and more. I see farmers trying to better understand where they fit in the universe, which is called a dinner plate. For many years in agri-food, I've always seen groups trying to advocate for their commodity in isolation. Please, Canadians, eat more beef. Please, Canadians, drink more milk. And really, that doesn't work anymore. What seems to be working are two things. One, you actually have advocates beyond yourself advocating for your position. And secondly, if you are to sell the virtues of your commodities to Canadians, sell it in a much broader context and try to appreciate your commodity as part of a much larger portfolio of different ingredients. The beef sector is a perfect example of how it's starting to shift. It is really providing a different message to Canadians over the last, I would say, 6 to 12 months. It's been really magical. It's very different, and instead of just selling beef to Canadians, they're selling a recipe and context and celebration and other products that are coming out of Canadian ag. So this, you can see that the sector is starting to learn about the consumer more and more.
Is there there's an upside to this fragmentation? I mean, that provides some challenges, but also some opportunities for the sector.
Oh, absolutely. What's frustrating for the sector is that I think we all know that we're dealing with a highly confused consumer, because there's so much information out there and there's so much misinformation. And that's why I know that a lot of farmers, even processors and grocers, I talk to all of them, and they're quite frustrated by all that. But I think we need to learn how to accept that and move beyond and say, okay, how do we embrace this new normal of hyper confusion in people's minds? And once you do that, I think you can move forward and come up with a really novel strategy.
Well, thanks very much for taking the time to spell this out for us, Sylvain.
My pleasure.
Sylvain Chalabrois is a food researcher with the University of Dalhousie. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host, Laura Rance. In a few minutes, we'll be talking about the latest escalation in the trade tiff between Canada and China over canola. But first, let's talk about last week's federal budget. Karen Breer writes for The Western Producer. She's joining us now to talk about how the agriculture sector fared in last week's spending promises. Karen, the release last week was characterized by many as a pre-election budget because it seemed to offer so many goodies to so many different sectors. What did you see? What stood out for you in that budget document?
Well, you're right. It is a pre-election budget. We will be going to the polls in October, and as such, there was something for everyone. And I guess that is what stood out in a way. It's a bit of a shotgun budget, aiming little bits of things at almost everybody.
I don't really remember a federal budget that has paid as much attention to agriculture, food, and rural issues as this one did. But how significant are these initiatives, or is it just window dressing?
Well, the agriculture initiatives are interesting in that the only significant funding commitment in amongst all the announcements is for the national food policy, and that doesn't start until 2020. There was $100 million for food processing, but otherwise there were announcements without significant dollar figures attached or dollar figures that aren't actually in the 2019-20 budget tables. So as one person I spoke to said, a lot of these are sort of a pledge, and that would include the compensation for supply-managed sectors.
So there really wasn't a lot of detail around that. How did the dairy sector react to that?
They're happy. They obviously want mitigation for what they're going to give up in the various trade agreements. They're really, I think, ticked, for lack of a better word, that they keep giving up. In every time a trade agreement is signed, they're giving up access. And so while they're happy they're going to get something, and this is specifically for the trade agreement with Europe and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, there's nothing yet to compensate them for the Canada-US-Mexico agreement, which, of course, hasn't been ratified yet.
Yeah. So now when we get to the national food policy, you mentioned that that's not supposed to start until 2020, which is, of course, after the election. But we've been involved in this process on a national scale for several years now, and there was a high degree of public interest in this. How is this being framed by the government at this stage?
Well, they have announced funding of $134.4 million over 5 years. And they're basing the policy on four main themes: helping Canadians access healthy food, encouraging people to buy Canadian food, supporting food security in the north, and indigenous communities, and reducing food waste. So depending on how it rolls out over the 5 years, it's hard to say how it's really going to affect anyone. In my mind, perhaps the most interesting part of it is the possible creation of a national school food program.
Oh, really? So kids would actually mm-hmm. learn about food in school?
They would actually be fed in schools. The federal government has said it will talk to the provinces because the provinces are in charge of education and it would be part of the school system. And they would partner with, you know, there are breakfast and lunch programs in various schools across the country already, so they may partner with some of those and build on their expertise in delivering these so that kids do have access to healthy food to eat.
Well, that's interesting. And I'm also, you know, I know that the Canadian Federation of Agriculture has been very supportive of a national food policy, as have many other groups in the Canadian context. But I think everyone has sort of a different definition of what that food policy is supposed to accomplish. Did you get any sense from farm organizations how they're reacting to that announcement?
Everybody is generally supportive at this point. Of course, you know, when a budget is announced, the devil is always in the details. And because it's a five-year process, things will roll out as they will. And we'll see what it really means when we get down to those details.
Well, thanks very much for joining us, Karen. We'll be watching to see how all this plays out, both pre- and post-election. But we'll follow up again in the future.
You're welcome.
That was the Western Producers, Karen Breer, based in Regina. The federal budget also announced a review of Canada's Grain Act and the Canadian Grain Commission, officially to modernize the agency and clear away regulatory redundancies. However, some are seeing a more sinister move behind the review and the way it came to pass. Alan Dawson writes for the Manitoba Cooperator. He's here to tell us about it. Hi, Alan.
Hi there.
So why has this review become so controversial?
I think it's mainly because of the process of how we got to having this review. I think the Grain Commission had been looked at by previous governments in recent years, and legislation that had come forward didn't get passed for various reasons. So there was an expectation, I think, that there would be another look at the Grain Commission and the Act. But the process itself, I think, how we got to this point is where the contention lies.
Well, what are your sources telling you about how this all came to pass?
Well, sources, and they're very reliable, have said that the Chief Commissioner, Patty Miller, at the Grain Commission, has been promoting the industry point of view, the grain company point of view on what should happen with this review, and that the other commissioners, the Assistant Chief Commissioner Doug Chorney and Commissioner Lonnie McCaig, really haven't had their fair input into the process, and both of those are fellows are farmers, and probably would maybe bring a different shed a different light on it than just the industry approach.
So what's at stake here?
Well, it depends on what comes out of the review. It could affect the quality control of Canadian grain exports. The Grain Commission administers the Grain Act, and part of the Grain Act says that the Grain Commission oversee quality control. It could have an impact on the governance of the Grain Commission, and also how the Grain Commission is funded. Currently, it's funded through fees it charges for various services. If there was a change to outward inspection, which is another part of what they're looking at, the certificate final that the Grain Commission issues, that's where most of the Grain Commission's revenue comes from, is on outward inspection. So if there's a change to that, which is being discussed, that could potentially impact how the Grain Commission earns revenue.
But besides from the revenue side of it, that outward inspection has been something the Grain Commission, the grain companies have had their sights set on for quite a few years, have they not? They've wanted to eliminate that step in the export process?
That's right. I don't know. I guess that maybe eliminate might be too strong a word. There's a discussion around making outward inspection not mandatory, or allowing private companies, inspection companies, to conduct the inspections instead of the Grain Commission. Right now, on all Canadian grain exports leaving a terminal in a ship, the Grain Commission is obliged to inspect that grain as it's loaded on the ship, and keep track of the grade and the weights, and then it issues a certificate final guaranteeing what the grade is on that ship.
Why is that a concern?
Pardon me?
Why would making that not be mandatory, why is that concerning to people?
Well, it's concerning to farmers, many farmers, because it's seen as critical to quality control. Canada has a quite involved quality control system, right from how varieties are registered and then how they're handled through the handling system and so on. And the certificate final is viewed as an important component of that process. Now, the grain companies, they argue that third-party inspectors would not undermine the Canadian quality brand, that because they're saying the Grain Commission should oversee, certify these inspectors and oversee their work to ensure that the grading and so on is done properly, and so the brand is protected.
Well, thanks for joining us to talk about this, Alan. We'll be watching this as it develops, and of course, we're in a pre-election mode, so changes may or may not occur before the election takes place.
That's right. It's the Ag Canada said that they hope to have the recommendations completed by the end of 2019, the elections in October, if not before. And so there's not a lot of time to, the recommendations will likely come after the election and maybe not even get dealt with until 2020.
Well, thanks, Alan. Alan Dawson covers grain industry affairs for the Manitoba Cooperator. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host, Laura Rantz. For our last item this week, we've invited Markets Farm analysts Mike Jubenville and Bruce Burnett to talk about the latest developments in what appears to be an escalating dispute with China over canola exports. Welcome to the show. Mike, it looks like China is upping the ante, at least as it relates to canola. I mean, how is the trade responding to the news that more than one company is being affected now by the block on exports?
You know, it certainly appears to be an escalation, but from the trade's point of view, the news behind this has not changed all that much, in that the amount of business that we've been doing with China since December, January has slowed down rather dramatically. But the news that has hit the public airways has certainly picked up once, when beginning of the month, when Richardson International had their export registration to provide Canadian canola to China, had that revoked because of a pathogen or a pest that had been detected in a shipment in the Chinese port. The Canola Council last week had made mention that we are no longer doing any business with China at this present time. That's not the case where a bit of a misconception that the Chinese government has officially said we're not taking Canadian canola anymore. I think it's just a volunteer retraction from the trade because of the added risks of doing business right now, that other companies are not wanting to participate. And of course, overnight, the second shoe dropped, that Viterra has now had its registration revoked. So there certainly is an escalation in terms of our ability to do business in China, but the fact of the matter is that business had slowed right down for a few months now.
So in revoking their right to export, that's really like an official documentation. They have to reapply to get that back, or how does that work?
Essentially, that'll be the case now until, you know, the assurances are provided between the Canadian Food Inspection Agency and the Customs Administration in China to have the proper precautions taken that whatever the pathogens that were detected in that cargo or cargoes are not going to be done again. I guess the real question here is there really an issue? Because certainly the samples that were taken from those cargoes before they left the West Coast turned up nothing. And the Chinese have been very reluctant to this point to share the results of the samples that they had taken and properly identify what the problem really is. Is it a pest? Is it an insect? Or is it a pathogen in the grain itself? Right now, we don't know.
So, Bruce, what about the other commodities? There were some reports last week that this could spill over into wheat or peas. Has there been any evidence of that to date, or has there been a general slowdown in what we're exporting to China?
There hasn't been any evidence, although really we don't get a lot of data. So it'll be a little bit down the line before we see any curtailments. I would suspect that the other commodities will be impacted to some extent here as we go forward, just because I view this more as a political situation than a phytosanitary situation or something like that. And so it depends a lot on how much pressure the Chinese government wants to put on Canada in the coming months here. But I would say certainly some of the other commodities may be impacted. The only thing being that most of the other commodities, let's say wheat, for example, doesn't really rely on China as big a customer as we do for the oilseeds, especially soybeans and canola.
Is there any evidence to suggest that China just doesn't need the canola right now? Or is this driven by the diplomatic tiff? Mike, why don't you take a shot at that first?
Ultimately, I think they do need the canola. However, as has been demonstrated in the ongoing U.S.-China trade war, they have put in incredible steps to try to minimize the use of American soybeans. And this is a commodity that is of a much larger scale than canola. Typically, the U.S. will send about 35 million tons of soybeans to China every year, as opposed to the 4.5 million tons of Canadian canola that goes into China. So I think potentially if this is an extended period of time that we have this type of relationship, I have a feeling grain companies are making moves to alter the supply chains internationally on how canola and soybeans have been moving in the recent years. So we could see more canola heading to other destinations, whether it's through our domestic crush, whether it's to places like Europe, United Arab Emirates, Pakistan, and such, to try to move product in different directions. And the Chinese may rely on other sources, whether it's soybeans or maybe Ukrainian, Russian canola and such, that will fill the gap.
Bruce, what's your take on that?
Well, I think this just speaks to the nature of the oilseed markets in general, in that a lot of the components in the products that you get from crushing oilseeds are interchangeable to some extent. So there is some base demand, but let's say, for instance, canola oil that you get from crushing the canola for the Chinese, there's probably a certain portion of the demand that is inelastic, or in other words, they absolutely have to have canola for it. But for a lot of the other stuff, other demand that they have that canola is being used for now, you may be able to use palm oil, you may be able to use soybean oil or sunflower oil or an alternate oil. So there's a lot of interchangeability that you have here. And so I think that's one of the things, I guess, basically in the favor of the Chinese, that really they can replace some of this. As Mike says, there's a certain amount of demand that they'll need this for. I think it's also important to understand that the Chinese themselves are harvesting their canola crop right now. So they will have domestic supplies available. So this probably fits in fairly well with the government. They can help support the domestic farmers a little bit by limiting the competition in the markets here in the next month or two, at least anyway, for sure.
And I think it probably just should be added that, you know, the canola industry within the makeup of the overall global oil seed matrix is a pretty mature industry. So I suspect that we'll probably develop avenues and directions for canola product. We'll never be able to replace entirely a demand giant like China, responsible for 40% of our exports of seed oil and meal. But I think we'll probably have other avenues starting to develop. And in a few months' time, I wouldn't even be surprised that, you know, in today's world, we've had a knee-jerk reaction. The marketplace, canola prices have come down rather dramatically. Canola is on sale right now, and other users are taking notice.
But that brings me to my next question, though. I mean, this is all over the news. I don't think there's any Canadian that hasn't heard about China and canola this week. But how much of an impact is this likely to have on farmers and on the amount of canola we grow in Canada this year? Bruce?
Well, certainly in the farmer's pocketbook, this has been straight out of their pockets. When you see the cash prices drop between $1, $1.50, let's say, from the highs that we saw last year, certainly I think the thing is that we will probably see a reduction in acreage this year. I don't know if it's going to be that large, though, because there are no alternatives really in the cropping rotation that are that much more profitable. So basically, I think we're probably going to reduce our canola area a bit, but not really a huge change from previous years.
Mike?
The fundamentals of the canola market, even if we were to subtract this Chinese dilemma we have on trade at the moment, probably suggests to me that we're marketplaces right now maybe $20 to $30 a ton under what we would be trading otherwise. So it's not like we would have a bullish scenario that's at play on canola per se, but looking across Western Canada, being canola the you know, the cash flow crop that it has become, the changing of acreage, I don't anticipate will be particularly significant. I think certainly some areas in the southern areas of the prairies that have some dry soil moisture conditions, from an agronomic point of view, they were probably making that decision anyway. But from an economic point of view, I can't see it making a dramatic change to the acres, but yep, I think we'll probably see some cutback develop over this year.
So it might be a year for people to try and get their rotations kind of back into a good balance then.
I think some people are thinking that way.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. We'll, of course, be watching this as it develops further. That's all we have for you this week on Between the Rows, but we'll be back again next week. Thanks for joining us. I'm Laura Rance.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to etr@farmmedia.com. Or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.